This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Tonight I will address the question, is humanity progressing? A question that naturally begs another question, namely, what is progress? You might think progress would be far too contentious and abstract to allow it to even be answered, but in fact, I think it's one of the easier questions that the human mind has ever posed. We can define progress as improvements in human flourishing. Human well-being can be measured. Life, health, sustenance, prosperity, peace, freedom, safety, knowledge, leisure, happiness. If they have increased over time, I submit, that would be progress. Well, let's go to the data. Beginning with the most precious thing of all, life. For most of human history, life expectancy at birth hovered around 30 years of age. But today, worldwide, it is 71 years. In the richer parts of the world, like Europe and the United States, it's more than 80 years. At the same time, there's been spectacular progress in parts of the world that lagged in the increase in life expectancy, including Asia and sub-Saharan Africa. One of the biggest contributors to low life expectancy at birth was the death of children. The particular vulnerable stage in life, and the death of a child will obviously lower the average more than the death of an elderly person. In Sweden, a quarter of a millennium ago, about one-third of children did not live to see their fifth birthday. Sweden brought its rate of child mortality down by a factor of 100, as have other parts of the world, such as Canada, South Korea, Chile, and Ethiopia. Sub-Saharan Africa is making great progress. Sustenance. Famine was one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse and could bring massive death and devastation to any part of the world. But with starting with the British agricultural revolution in the 18th century, the ability to grow more calories and to get them where they're needed, famines have become rarer and rarer and today occur only in the most remote and war-torn parts of the world. Prosperity. For most of human history, economic growth was pretty much minuscule, as we can see in a graph that plots the gross world product from the year one to the present. And it shows that for about 1600 years, economic growth was about one pixel high. Then, with the Industrial Revolution and the spread of education, institutions like markets and finance and the globalization of trade, gross world product has increased by a factor of about 200 since the early 18th century. And this would be a dubious claim to progress if all of those gains went to the proverbial 1%. But in fact, they have gone to reducing the rate of global poverty, defined conventionally as $1.90 per person per day in 2015 U.S. dollars. By that standard, in 200 years ago, 90% of the world's population lived in extreme poverty. That is now down to 9%. Peace. For most of human history, the normal state of relations between states and empires was war, and peace was merely a brief interlude between wars. But after the worst war in human history, the world did something of a U-turn, and since then, since 1946, battle deaths per capita have declined from about 20 per 100,000 per year in the late 1940s to less than 1 per 100,000 per year today. The decline of war has been highly bumpy. There were peaks for the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Iran-Iraq War, and the Syrian Civil War, but each peak was lower than the preceding one. And today we're living in a period of unique safety when it comes to chance of being killed in a war. Just one milestone in this progress, sometimes called the Long Peace, was that when the government of Colombia signed a peace agreement with the FARC guerrillas 3 years ago, it brought to an end the last war in the Western Hemisphere and the last remnant of the Cold War. Freedom and rights. We've all been alarmed at the threats to democracy in countries like Turkey and Venezuela and Russia and Hungary. Nonetheless, if you add up all of the democracies and autocracies in the world and scale them by how democratic or how autocratic they are, you can see that the world has never been more democratic than it has been in the past decade. A majority of countries are more democratic than autocratic. A majority of people live in countries that are more democratic than autocratic. Unless that seem incredible, recall that, say, when I was a college student in the 1970s, half of Europe was behind the Iron Curtain and dominated by totalitarian communist dictatorships. Spain and Portugal were fascist dictatorships. Greece was under the control of a military junta, as was much of Latin America and East Asia, all of them democratic today. The power of governments to brutalize their citizens has been eroded, such as the death penalty. There have been but three abolitions of the death penalty a year for the last three decades, most recently Malaysia, just last month. And if current trends continue, the death penalty will have vanished from the face of the earth by the end of the 2020s. Not that anyone's predicting that that will happen, but just to give you an idea of the pace of change. And in country after country, homosexuality has been decriminalized, most recently in India, Lebanon, and Trinidad and Tobago just in the last few months. For most of human history, children were set to work in fields and factories, but child labor, from a rate of about 30% in England 150 years ago, was eliminated in the 21st century, as were other countries such as Italy, and the world as a whole has seen great progress in reducing the rate of child labor. In the United States, scary headlines about bullying and cyberbullying, the violent victimization of children at school has been in decline, as have rates of physical and sexual abuse. Indeed, pretty much all forms of violence, interpersonal violence, have been in decline. This is a long-running process. It began in the Middle Ages in Europe when the consolidation of medieval kingdoms brought about a reduction in the rate of homicide from about 35 per 100,000 per year to 1 per 100,000 per year, process that's replicated whenever frontier regions are brought under the control of law, such as in colonial New England, the American Wild West, and even in countries that remain violent today, such as Mexico. They used to be even more violent a century ago. The homicide in Mexico was five times higher a century ago. Not just homicide has come down, but violence against women, such as rates of domestic violence against wives and girlfriends, and rates of rape and sexual assault. Knowledge. The natural state of humanity is ignorance, and schooling used to be a privilege for the fortunate few. But the rate of basic education has gone from less than 20% 200 years ago. This would be, say, completing elementary school and a year or two of high school. From less than 20% a couple of hundred years ago to 80% today. And every part of the world has seen the progress, including some of the poorer areas such as the Middle East, South and East Asia, and Sub-Saharan Africa, all showing spectacular gains. And in what I would say is the most incredible, astonishing, difficult-to-believe example of progress that I have come across, we have been getting smarter. This is true. In a well-documented phenomenon known as the Flynn effect, IQ scores have increased by 3 points a decade all over the world for a century. So people today are 30 IQ points smarter than their ancestors were a century ago. Well, does any of this improve the quality of our life? And in many ways, it has. For example, typical work week 150 years ago in Europe and the United States was more than 60 hours. Today, it's fewer than 40 hours. And thanks to the universal penetration of running water and electricity in developed countries and the widespread adoption of labor-saving devices like washing machines, vacuum cleaners, refrigerators, dishwashers, stoves, and microwaves, the amount of our lives that we forfeit to housework, which people indicate is their favorite way of spending their time, has gone from 60 hours a week to fewer than 15 hours a week. Well, these are all things that measures that economists like to play with, do they actually make a difference in what ultimately counts in happiness? And the answer is that they do. that there is a strong but a logarithmic relationship between life satisfaction and income, measured in gross domestic product per capita. So obviously an extra $1,000 makes a poor person happier than a rich person. But nonetheless, the relationship holds between countries and within countries. People in rich countries are happier. Richer people within every country are happier. The expectation is that as the world gets richer, people ought to get happier. And as best we can tell, on average, that seems to be true. In 71% of countries for which we have longitudinal data on rates of happiness, there have been increases since over the last 35 years. Interestingly, the United States is not one of them. The United States got a little less happy, but the United States was pretty happy to begin with. Let me wrap up with three questions about progress that I suspect have occurred to many of you. One of them is, what caused progress? And in my book, Enlightenment Now, as the subtitle indicates, I suggest it's been the growth of reason, science, and humanism. Now, you might say, well, what kind of an answer is that? Isn't it obvious that we should all adopt reason, science, and humanism? Aren't those words like motherhood that no one could possibly be opposed to? Well, not exactly. There are alternative goals, sources of meaning and purpose in life, such as religious morality, divine commandments, authoritarian nationalism, and populism, and reactionary ideologies that hark back to some golden age and see the trajectory of humanity not as progress but degeneration. And for that matter, utopian, romantic, and messianic ideologies that look forward to some utopia. Second question, even if there has been progress, are we better off denying it? Make sure we don't slip back in complacency. I don't think so. I think that we're not best off with a view of the world that is pessimistic or a view of the world that is optimistic, but a view of the world that is accurate. Obviously, we have to be aware of danger and suffering and injustice wherever they occur. But we also have to be aware of how they can be reduced, because even if there are dangers of falling into complacency and apathy, there are also dangers of thoughtless, fact-free pessimism. One of them is fatalism. If all our efforts to make the world a better place have been an abject failure, and the world is just getting worse and worse despite all of our efforts, well, why waste time and money on a hopeless cause? Why throw good money after bad? As Jesus said, the poor you will always have with you. The other danger is radicalism. If you think that our institutions are failing and beyond all hope of reform, you'll be open to calls to smash the machine, drain the swamp, burn the empire to the ground in the hope that anything that rises out of the rubble is bound to be better than what we have now, a rather dangerous response, or receptive to aspiring leaders who promise, only I can fix it. Final question, is progress inevitable? And the answer is, of course not. Progress does not mean that everything becomes better for everyone, everywhere, all the time. That would not be progress. That would be a miracle. And progress is not a miracle. Progress consists of using knowledge to solve problems. Problems are inevitable, and solutions create new problems that must be solved in their turn. So the existence of problems today does not mean that there has been no progress, because the problems of yesterday were worse. As Franklin Pierce Adams put it, nothing is more responsible for the good old days than a bad memory. The upshot is that progress can continue if we remain committed to reason, science, and humanism, and if we don't, it probably won't. Thank you.
In the book, you spend a good deal of time talking, for example, about the availability heuristic as a source of failing in problem solving and the remedies to it. And maybe you could share a little bit about that and a couple of the other cognitive drivers in the book, because I think that that would help people understand a little bit more deeply this notion of progress.
Yes, there. The availability heuristic is part of the explanation of why people are unaware of the progress that's taken place. It's an idea that was suggested by the late psychologist Amos Tversky and his collaborator Daniel Kahneman. Many of you may have heard of Kahneman as the author of the bestseller Thinking Fast and Slow and the winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics in, I believe, 2005. This is the idea that the human mind tends to estimate frequency, probability, prevalence by a mental shortcut of using basically its own search engine as a guide to frequency. The more quickly you can remember something, the more easily you can imagine it, the more quickly a narrative or an image comes to mind, the more common you think it is. One example is that if people are asked to judge what are the biggest threats to life and limb, people think that tornadoes kill more people than asthma attacks. Asthma attacks kill about 40 times as many people as tornadoes, but tornadoes make really good television. Asthma attacks, not so much. So we see the tornado sweep through the trailer park in Oklahoma, and we think, oh my God, it must kill a lot of people. But in fact, it's just an unforgettable image out of whack with the actual data. It's one of, if you think about what the news consists of, it consists of things that happen, not things that don't happen. There's a cliche in journalism, we cover the planes that crash, not the planes that take off. You never see a journalist saying, I'm reporting live from a country that's at peace, or a city that has not been attacked by terrorists. So as long as violence and disasters haven't vanished from the face of the earth, which they never will, there'll always be enough instances to fill the news, and people can have the impression that the world is as bad as it has ever been, or has gotten worse, simply because all of the areas that have gotten better never make the news. Also because the improvements tend to be incremental, a few percentage points a year, which can compound, whereas things that happen suddenly are generally bad things. It's easier for things to go wrong very quickly than to go right very quickly. So that's part of the answer to the question of why people are unaware of the progress that I think is visible when you look at data. There are other aspects of cognitive psychology that are relevant to how the progress happens in the first place, namely the application of reason and science. Humanism, at least so I argue, the paradox is how can we be, as a species, so rational? We've figured out the secrets of life and matter and the universe, or at least a lot of them, but at the same time so irrational. You know, how can the same species that thought up the theory of evolution and the structure of DNA also believe that Hillary Clinton ran a child sex ring out of a pizzeria outside of Washington, or that vaccines cause autism? I think the answer, as a cognitive psychologist, is we do have, we are born, nature gave us a certain kernel of rationality, and our ancestors used it to outsmart plants and animals, to devise tools and traps and form coalitions. By itself, the rationality of a human being is not enough to lead to progress. However, a group of humans that agree to abide by certain norms of reason, such as free speech, even though I want to be right, and a lot of prestige and glory and power come from me trying to convince everyone, you guys all get to criticize me, and I can't jail you if you do. There's therefore a marketplace of ideas where good ideas can drive out bad ideas. Empirical testing, no matter how plausible an idea is, until you confront it against reality, give reality a chance to falsify it, see if it survives, you really don't know whether it's true or not. Logic, just some trains of thought that are intuitively compelling actually don't make sense when you put them under a microscope and look at the step-by-step logic. So that's another kind of tool that we have invented and spread. To the extent that people abide by those rules, then we can be collectively more rational than any of us is individually. But, of course, they don't always apply. And so it's a mixture of the power of human cognition with the institutions and norms that allow it to flourish collectively.
One of the principal premises of your view of the possibilities of the good side of human nature, and you describe human morality as being ambiguous in its nature at times, is your concept of sympathy, that because there is a trait of sympathy in human cognition, it is possible for us to empathize, generalize, and in a sense, deduce certain rules of equity and fairness. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, there is. This is a major idea around the time of the Enlightenment in the 18th century, is that humans are endowed with a faculty of sympathy and ability to feel others' pain. You could call it compassion or empathy, commiseration, they called it then, pity. By itself, as with human cognition, just left to our own devices, what evolution gave us is really not enough to lead to progress, because even though we have the capacity for sympathy, we tend to focus it on cute little furry baby animals, on our blood relatives, on our clan, our tribe, our allies. And it takes a push to expand our circle of sympathy to embrace the nation, the alliance, and ultimately all of humanity. I do think that there are nudges that expand our circle of sympathy, such as journalism, history, realistic fiction, travel, the cosmopolitan forces that mean that people aren't confined to their tribe and village, but get to experience the lived worlds of people unlike themselves and come to the realization that they are people with interests and pleasures and pains like each of us is.
Great. So before we go into some of the challenges that may exist for the world, I'd like to give a moment for understanding why it is that my colleagues may be really good at what they do. And there's a section of the book where you talk about, in effect, the revenge of the nerds. Not that my colleagues are nerds, but let me be clear about that, but that there are, in fact, people who are super forecasters, and it's not an accident. And it's a contrast to many of the people who we view as experts.
Yeah, so this is work pioneered by another cognitive psychologist, Philip Tetlock, now at UPenn, who held experts' feet to the fire by actually having them lay out predictions that could actually be tested within some reasonable window, 5 years. Will more countries leave the Eurozone? Will the price of oil go up or down? Will a new war break out in Latin America? A large number of questions. He found that most pundits scored about the same as a chimpanzee picking bananas with the answers printed at them, especially those with a strong something that they were known for, a big idea, a political ideology, a bulldog for the right, a bulldog for the left. He did find that there were people who could predict way above chance. He called them super forecasters. And this really was the revenge of the nerds, in that they thought in quantitative terms, not that they were mathematical whizzes, but they were comfortable thinking in guesstimates, in orders of magnitude, 10, 100, 1,000, 10,000. They were Bayesian in the sense of doing probabilistic reasoning according to the theorem of the eponymous Reverend Bayes, namely to first take into account the priors. How likely is an idea before you even look at the data based on everything you know so far? Then how likely would be the observations that you have at hand given one possibility about the state of the world and another? Divide that by how common are those observations across the board on any possibility. They didn't literally always do the math, but that was the way they balanced their intuitions. They were willing to be proven wrong. They treated hypotheses as tools, not as cherished possessions that they needed to defend. They believed in the wisdom of crowds. They consulted other super forecasters and tried to merge or triangulate their predictions with others. And they had a true appreciation of contingency and chance and randomness. They were more likely to say that if you were to rewind the tape of history and play it again, things could have turned out very different. The people who believe in grand dialectics and historic forces and inevitabilities and the direction of history, they tended to rank with the chimpanzees.
I don't know where deans fit within that particular context. Let me now turn to some issues that you identify in the book and why you feel that they are somewhat overrated. And let's start with the question of terrorism.
Yeah, so terrorism, by definition, is a tactic for creating terror. So it is designed to strike fear into the hearts of people. But in terms of the actual damage that it does, it is, while no human death can be treated frivolously, there are lots of things that can kill us out there, and terrorism is one is in general not one of them. That is, it kills fewer people every year than lightning strikes, bee and wasp stings. No comparison to police blotter homicides from road rage, from barroom brawls, from domestic quarrels, to say nothing of accidental deaths like falling off ladders, texting while driving. But terrorists game the system of journalism. They know that one way to draw attention to themselves and their cause is to kill a few innocent people in circumstances in which we can all picture ourselves draw attention and perhaps provoke a disproportionate response. So the outside of war zones, where it's not easy to draw the line between insurgency and terrorism and where most terrorism takes place, but in the rest of the world, terrorism, while awful and tragic, is really low on the list of threats to life and limb. And I think the combination of the habits of journalism and the rhetoric of politics inflate the actual threat.
Let's take an example that you do take with a greater degree of seriousness about its magnitude, which is nuclear weapons. And maybe you could walk through the reasoning in the book about the issue of nuclear weapons.
Well, I don't think that the clock is ticking away toward doomsday, and I don't think that the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists doomsday clock serves much purpose. This is the one whose hands are adjusted from between 2 minutes to midnight to 17 minutes to midnight, kind of a PR stunt. Nonetheless, one has to take seriously risks that, even if small, would be so catastrophic that we ought to do everything possible to prevent that from happening. And I do think that we should think more seriously about making nuclear weapons less tempting to use, by having greater safeguards than just the whims of the commander-in-chief, to try to make the systems less vulnerable to accidental sightings. Now, they probably have been getting safer. The close calls seem to be getting less frequent, but still they're not negligible. And to move toward a world perhaps with the where nuclear weapons are abolished outright in incremental steps, such as reducing the number, something we've already done. The size of the world's nuclear arsenal has been reduced by about 85% since the height of the Cold War, with policies such as no first use, such as never using nuclear weapons against a non-nuclear state, through negotiating tactics of gradual reciprocation and reductions that might get us to zero. This may sound like an idea from bearded professors and beatniks from the 1960s strumming guitars and singing folk songs, but in fact it has been endorsed by some of the most realistic of the Cold War realists, by Sam Nunn and William Perry and George Shultz and Henry Kissinger, all of whom have come out in favor of the total abolition of nuclear weapons, as famously Ronald Reagan did, at least in a moment of musing in the mid-1980s. So it's not a crazy idea. It's not a romantic utopian idea, and it is one that I think that we ought to give more attention to.
Let me use the example of nuclear weapons to go into some of the dimensions that may make the long line of progress that you illustrated a little less comforting. You know, in the 1930s, as we faced the Great Depression, there was a strong argument by the economists of the day in the laissez-faire of economics that there should be no massive government intervention to try to deal with the Great Depression because in the long run, things would work out, the markets would adjust. And Keynes famously replied, in the long run, we are all dead. And that issue, it really deals with the time scale at which progress and responses to problems take place. And it's a fundamental issue for making public policy, and it's a fundamental issue for society. So the first aspect of this, then, is that it may be that there are problems that really, despite the long time trends, are truly massive and disruptive in some medium term. And the 1920s and 1930s and 40s are a good example of that type of disruption in the curves of progress that you spoke about. The second thing that nuclear weapons represents is that the capacity to do damage due to the progress of technology, due to the fact that we live in a much more heavily interdependent and, if you would, skilled world where there are many more people who have the ability to make decisions that have large impacts on the world is getting greater, so that the oops moment may be much worse in any particular moment, as in the case of nuclear weapons. And then there are certain problems where even with reason and science, we are able to manage them better, but they have some properties that make them hard to manage. In your book, for example, in talking about climate change, you acknowledge a problem that my colleague, Professor David Victor, has emphasized in his work on global climate policy, that there is a tragedy of the commons where people do not, in a sense, internalize the full costs of their actions on others, and that at the same time, that leads to a sort of shirking on the collective task in front of us. So those things are, in a sense, objective strategic dilemmas. We have greater capacity for doing damage when we make mistakes in calculating those dilemmas. And in the medium term, we could run into some deep problems. So today, we're in a conversation where people in the meetings that we've held throughout this day with experts from around the world, there was a recurring worry that not that we're at the moment of the world falling apart, but that the problem solving that has marked progress since 1945 may be running into a pause, and that there is a very outside chance of an oops moment, maybe not nuclear war, maybe not a world war, but that there could be a major setback for some of the progress of the world order. How do you think about that in regards to your general framework?
Well, there could be. I mean, progress is not a magical force that protects us against threats and problems. And quite the contrary, the forces of the universe are constantly grinding us down. We've got the second law of thermodynamics, that the more ways for things to go wrong than for things to go right, and anytime we use energy, there's some loss, and we can't create new energy. Evolution is pitted against us. There are always organisms that can make us sick, that can eat our food. So any gains that we have made are because we've applied our ingenuity to push back at the forces of the universe. So yes, there could be problems, threats. Nuclear war is one we've already talked about. Whether the world is getting more fragile, where there's a greater likelihood of a huge catastrophe, that's not at all clear. Just as an example, I mentioned briefly, if there's a crop failure in one part of the country, we don't have a famine in most of the world because you just ship food from somewhere else. That couldn't have done that 100 years ago. It would have spoiled. There wasn't the transportation infrastructure. There was Black Death that killed a quarter of Europe. There's no guarantee that there won't be another pandemic, but certainly we've got a medical infrastructure that can develop vaccines and antivirals and antibiotics a lot more quickly than they could have 100 years ago when the son of a sitting president of the United States died of an infected abscess. Now, we can't be complacent about our resilience, and there are, for example, the threats of antibiotic-resistant pathogens that we ought to take seriously. We ought to take seriously all the threats, the vulnerability of cyberspace to sabotage or even warfare. If we don't take the threat seriously, then things could go wrong. But nor do I think that it's just a ticking bomb that we're enjoying ourselves on the way down from a fall off a 32nd floor. That it's only a matter of time before everything explodes. It all depends on what we do now.
Right. So let's take the example of democracy. Where you presented strong evidence that democracy is in many respects at a high tide, although we've seen some reversion to what my colleague Steph Haggard often calls competitive autocracies replacing democracy. And when we take a look at the larger picture of, for example, the evidence that you cite of the rise of, if you would, more cosmopolitan and more sympathetic ideals in the public space that give us hope for democratic progress, we're also seeing from that same data from Professor Engelhardt and some of his collaborators that the percentage of vote in Western Europe, for example, for populists, both in the raw vote and in their parliamentary shares, have nearly tripled since the 1960s. So that at the same time that we've gone through a period of an intense growth in education in many respects, we've made enormous scientific progress, and we have made, as you've said, great material progress in general, we still start to see the beginnings of something that seems to fall outside of this ideal of democratic reasoning and sympathy that you point to in the book.
Yeah, so the it's true that Engelhardt and Norris, who've tracked votes for populist parties, have shown an increase, especially in the last, compared to 25 years ago, or especially 50 years ago. Although the populism seems to be, over the last 5 years, to be plateauing. There's some reasons to think that it does not represent the wave of the future, just because of certain demographic trends, including ones that Engelhardt and Norris document, such as that there is support for populist parties kind of falls off a cliff as you go down the generational cohorts, that it's authoritarian populism is very popular among, or not very popular, but it's most popular among aging baby boomers and the last members of the silent generation, less popular among Gen X, still less among the millennials, and least popular among the Gen Zs. Now, this would be irrelevant if people become more populist as they get older, as in the old saying that if attributed to many authors, that if you're if you're not a liberal when you're 20, you have no heart, and if you are a liberal when you're 60, you have no head. It comes in all kinds of variations. That turns out to be false, that that people pretty much keep their political convictions with them as they age. And again, actually, it's the World Values Survey people like Ron Engelhardt who have shown that, which suggests that the baby boomers kind of shuffle off the stage and get replaced by younger cohorts, there'll be some erosion in support for populism. And there are other demographic factors that probably will push against it as well, such as urbanization. Authoritarian populism is most popular in rural and ex-urban areas. And education. Support falls off with education, and the world is getting more educated. This is not to minimize the harm that can be done, such as the fact that both sides of the Atlantic, populists are trying to renew nuclear arms race. They're pushing back at the measures such as pricing of carbon emissions and other pollutants that would internalize these dangerous externalities, that indeed it's only by thinking about why unregulated systems would naturally lead to possibly dangerous pollution and emissions that we can think up policies, whether they're cap and trade or pricing or even top-down maximum levels. It's by analyzing the problems and figuring out what it would take to get to a solution that we can propose policies like that, and that we should genuinely be concerned at politicians and political movements that don't recognize these needs, don't recognize the problems that have to be solved and how to solve them.
Well, I'd like to return to that issue of climate change and the environment in a moment, but I want to just push a little bit further on the popular controversy over globalization. In the United States, part of my experience working in the Obama administration was trying to figure out the level of congressional support for trade agreements. And although general popular opinion surveys show that the American people in general support trade, when you start to count congressional seats and votes, the situation has actually become much worse. The stress in the Democratic Party has been now matched by a flip in the support in Congress in the Republican Party. And so what can happen in these circumstances is that it isn't so much that you're debating the particular economic merits of a trade agreement. You're really debating something that it represents, which is a sense that global boundaries are eroding, that control over solving your own internal problems are diminishing. And those things are very real to political leaders representing local constituencies. And in reading your book, I read a number of reviews of it. One that really struck me was a review by Professor Allison Gopnik, who's a very distinguished psychologist at Berkeley. And she wrote a really laudatory review of your book in The Atlantic. But then she said, but maybe there's a problem with globalization that also has its roots in our cognitive operatives. And what she cited was evidence that human attachment to specific places and particular people underpins our commitment, care, trust, and love, in a sense what you call sympathy in a broader way, and that perhaps at one of the consequences of globalization may be reinforced by the fact that imagine you're a bright young woman who wants to be a great neuroscientist. Where do you go? You're not going to stay home in Kentucky. You're going to come to one of the super magnet talent centers, San Diego, Cambridge, Carnegie Mellon, Pittsburgh, et cetera. And that, in the sense, the ability to, for many people, to have a local life with deep attachment and ways is somehow people feeling being eroded, either by objective fact or by the sense that globalization makes it less a matter of their local control. So could you explore that for us and about the psychological premise that went into this argument?
Yeah, I find the argument a little odd, because it's surely if a brilliant woman can escape a village where in earlier times the family elders would have chosen a spouse for her. She'd have to pump out the babies as soon as she was married. Her education would be curtailed, and all her brilliance would be kind of withheld from the world, from being applied to solving problems. Now she can move to a city, and maybe she will have to get on a plane to see her mom instead of or her mother-in-law instead of living in the mother-in-law's house. This strikes me as progress. At least she has the choice. If she wanted to stay home in Kentucky, no one's forcing her to leave at the point of a gun. But the fact that we have the options, both because of technology and crucially because of changes in women's empowerment, women can do things that they couldn't a century ago or even 50 years ago. Everything has costs, so it is true that you can't simultaneously be a Nobel Prize-winning neuroscientist at UCSD or MIT and enjoy all of the closeness of village life in Kentucky. But it's hardly an indictment of modernity that we now have the choice. And also, this close-knit village life, it's not all it's cracked up to be. There's a reason that we or our parents or our grandparents fought so hard to escape it. It's stultifying. It's stifling. It's literally depressing, in the sense that these are data that came out after Enlightenment now, so I wasn't able to include them. But The Economist ran a feature a few months ago showing that world suicide rates, contrary to popular impressions, have been going down by a lot, 40% or so in the last 25 years. And a big driver, not in the United States, where the suicide rate has been creeping up since it's one of its low points in 1999, but for the world as a whole, it's been going down. And the reason is people are leaving villages, and so you don't have a woman living in the household of her mother-in-law, pounding millet, pumping out one kid after another, being bossed around by her mother-in-law, and killing herself. Now she can move to the city and have some autonomy. And people really do like autonomy, even if it comes at the expense of some closeness.
Fair enough. So I want to return to the area of climate change, because I thought the chapter in the book on climate change was particularly interesting as an application of some of the logic that you lay out about problem solving and about where and how to identify the nature of a problem. So maybe you could share with us tonight some of those insights that you offered about the question of climate change.
Yeah, so climate change is another problem that is undeniable, that we're currently not on track to solving, but that we ought to. I think one of the starting points I suggest is that we don't just give up and say we're doomed. Let's just enjoy life while we can. Let our grandchildren worry about it, or let our grandchildren suffer. We ought to take it on as a problem. We also, most obviously, and first and foremost, not deny that it is a problem. That the scientific case for human-made climate change is by now overwhelming. We can see it all around us, and it could become, with some probability, really, really serious, potentially even catastrophic. At least that has a high enough probability that it would be foolish to dismiss it. I don't think that we should fold climate change into a bundle of every other issue that politically gets our hearts pumping. I think the Green New Deal is a disaster when it comes to dealing with climate change. I think that even though the denial on parts of the American right of the reality of human-made climate change is disastrous, I think that some of the efforts of the left to and the kind of the hard green, if that's a term, to urge us to undo the Industrial Revolution, go back into harmony with nature, live small, is counterproductive at best and dangerous at worst, because it's not going to happen. People, the use of energy to improve human welfare has been one of the drivers of the progress that we've enjoyed, and there are a couple of billion people who are going to want to enjoy the same benefits that we in the rich countries have enjoyed. So whatever is going to happen, there's going to be an enormous thirst for energy, and that's a good thing. That's how we got to get kids out of the fields. That's how we got to get women. How we got women out of the kitchen. That's how we get to see the world. How we get to see our mothers if she gets sick on the other coast. We don't want to give up that lifestyle. The question is, how do we get the benefits of an energy-rich lifestyle without bringing on possible climate catastrophes? And that calls for decarbonizing the energy sector with a combination. I suggest, I can't take credit for these ideas, but I do advocate them, of a policy, particular some kind of carbon pricing that would internalize the external externalities, the cost to everyone of private transactions, such as driving a car and using an air conditioner. That should be factored into the price that we pay, so that there are billions of people who are making decisions now in the future in the direction of less greenhouse gas emissions. Now, as we've seen in the past year, if you simply impose a carbon tax, then people will put on yellow vests and start spray painting the Arc de Triomphe and turning over cars. So it has to be combined with some way of mitigating the costs to poorer people. So it has to be accompanied by some kind of rebate. And in combination with technology, that is, technologies that give us the most energy with, as quickly as possible, zero emissions and eventually negative emissions. These would include the obvious ones of renewables like solar and wind, but also, I argue, nuclear power, which is the most scalable, abundant, round-the-clock form of energy that we know of. Its dangers have been exaggerated by some of the same psychological biases that we spoke about at the outset that make terrorism outsize in people's imaginations. Whether it be not retiring the plants that we now have that are running just fine and which lead to increase in emissions whenever we shut them down, but also building out plants, especially in countries like China and India, where there's going to be a huge growing thirst for energy, and then with a transition to a new generation of nuclear technology, small modular reactors, perhaps new technologies, perhaps even fusion, which doesn't always seem to be, as the cliche put it, 30 years away, and it always will be. But there have been some advances at MIT, Department of Nuclear Engineering, if I can mention a rival to this university, where there really does seem to have been a breakthrough. Anyway, we'll need new technologies.
And a few advances here locally, I see some
and locally
of the people
too,
are
yes.
investing
so no,
in
no
it.
No offense to the local advances in fourth generation and other nuclear technologies. And eventually, perhaps the carbon capture and storage, that we've got to go not just zero, but negative. Because even the carbon that we have pumped into the atmosphere and will continue to do will heat up the atmosphere unless we figure out how to suck it out.
One of the legacies of the Enlightenment was the notion of cosmopolitanism, sort of an idea that there was a universal shared way of using reason and enlightenment in the world. Spreading around the world. And that was certainly one of the artifacts of the first era of globalization, if you would. Today, we are really living in an age where the capacity for discovery and research, the level of education around the world, it's truly no longer the predominant monopoly of the traditional wealthy countries. There is truly great discovery going on around the world, even in places that many people in the audience don't fully recognize, such as in Africa, where there's an enormous amount of creative research being done and engineering problem solving in many ways. So we're living in a new age of the spread of knowledge. Many of these things are tied to the values that you advocate for in the book. But does cosmopolitanism ever serve in tension with the pride and cultural differences and history? And how do we think about that balance as we go forward in the world?
Yeah, no, another profound question. The humans are tribal in the sense that we tend to submerge our identity with some larger group that we feel as some kind of extended kin or an affinity to. We tend to divide ourselves into groups based on sometimes rather flimsy pretexts and immediately think the worst of the other group. On the other hand, those cognitive tribes, if you will, the group that we think that we belong to, don't have to coincide with a race or with any fixed unit like a nation or a state or a religion. We are flexible enough to imagine ourselves as belonging to many overlapping tribes. You can be an Italian and an American and a Catholic and a citizen of the world and a fan of the Celtics or the Chargers or a user of Apple or Windows, each one of which defines a tribe that has shifting pattern of friends and enemies, perhaps. But one of them can be a citizen of the world, the ideal of cosmopolitanism. So the ideal would be that if we retain our local identities in terms of, you know, cuisine and music and dress and humor and symbols and rituals, but when it comes to things that count, like, you know, military competition or economic cooperation, then we think more broadly, and we avail ourselves of the huge cafeteria of opportunities that globalization presents. You know, I love my mother's home cooking, but I also like the option of going out for Thai food, and and the world is richer if everyone can do that, even if it means that it's less exotic to visit Thailand. You've already had taste of the food. Still, I think it's a better world when you can go out for Thai when you want to.
I think that it would be appropriate right now to thank a cosmopolitan, an enlightened view of the world from Professor Pinker. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.